Coming up on today's program, The Search for Climate Solutions. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend. As always, thanks for sharing your weekend with WISO. This week, our radio station, the Ohio Newsroom, and public radio stations across the country joined NPR to tell local stories about climate solutions. In the next half hour, we'll hear about some of those solutions. Up first, from solar and geothermal energy systems to hybrid vehicles to educational programs, the Sisters of the Precious Blood in Trotwood are working hard to find their own climate solutions and to share them with others. Jen Morin Williamson is the Peace, Justice, and Ecology Coordinator for the Sisters. She tells us about some of the solutions they're working on and why.
Well, your timing is excellent. I don't know if you knew that or not. Because the Sisters, the congregation was really inspired by Pope Francis in 2015. Actually, May 24th is the day that he released his encyclical called Laudato Si. Basically, it's about care for creation. And he says in there that to be fully human, to be fully people of faith, we have to care for creation. And so we can't be fully human without caring for creation. And so he had talked to scientists from around the world. And, you know, especially at that time, there were people who said, oh, climate change is not, it's fake. And so he gathered these scientists together and wrote this document and said, no, it's not. Humans are impacting the environment in a very negative way and accelerating that. And as people of faith, again, we are compelled to do something about that. So the Sisters took that really, really seriously and started looking into solar. And so at first they tested it on two of their residences here in Trotwood, and that went really, really well. And so then in 2018, they decided to do the solar field to provide about 60% of their energy for their retirement home, or as some people might say, their mother house. So that has been up and running and going great. One of the things as well as being caring for creation is underneath the solar fields that they planted a native prairie. So again, just not just about the energy, it's pretty multifaceted. With that, they, like you said, they started doing things with geothermal, changing out all the windows and doors to make them energy efficient, and then looking at every little thing that they could do. They bought all their cars are hybrids. I'm working on them getting electric cars. We're not there yet, but I'm working on that. So that's kind of the background of that. And then just so in 2023, Pope Francis wrote another encyclical, actually another letter saying, hey, and it was called Laudate Deum, saying, hey, as people of faith, you're not paying attention. It's not just climate change. It's a climate crisis now. And he really called out wealthy countries like the United States and saying what we're doing impacts the climate. And it's the poorest of the poor around the world who suffer from that. So what more can we do? So that's about the time I came on working with the Sisters. So working with their legacy of being educators and myself having raised six children, I know how to educate a family is to educate kids, right? So we implemented in several schools in Catholic schools in the Dayton area, a thing called the Precious Planet Project. So we worked with the schools, their science department, and their religion department for their regular science fair. If they did an environmental project, then we would come and help judge them. And the top project in the eighth grade would receive a $500 scholarship to their school of their choice. So that's been a way, not only now are the children learning about Laudato Si, but now they're telling their family about it. And they're talking about how it is, again, not just a moral obligation, it's a spiritual obligation.
And you've got some current projects underway, correct?
Well, most recently, we've been working with Catholic schools in this area as well to compost school waste. In fact, just yesterday, I was at one of the local schools and we did a food waste audit in conjunction with the sustainability department at Kettering, the city of Kettering, trying to get them to compost their food. One of the things that I found out just blew my mind is that the food that we put in the landfill, because it's airtight, basically, it creates methane. The bacteria that breaks it down creates methane. Our Montgomery County solid waste captures about 30% of that. The rest of it goes into the environment to create greenhouse gases. That is not good. That warms up our planet. So, but if you compost them outside where the bacteria is the more natural bacteria, it's carbon dioxide. It's much better for the environment and you get dirt, right? So that's great. So we're working with these schools to kind of help show them how much waste they have. So the waste audit we did yesterday, about 87% of the garbage from lunch was either food or liquid. So if you can dump the liquid down the drain and you compost the rest of that, wow, you're making a big impact on what you're not putting into the landfill.
You've got an effort called Plastic Free July. I noticed there's a lot of stuff on your website, so you're all very active.
I would love them to look at our website and look at other resources of things you can do. Sometimes it's just the one thing at a time, and it may not feel like a whole lot, but one thing and you do the next thing and then you build it in. But I would like to say that if people would be interested in being involved in the Care for Creation Task Force, that's part of the Archdiocese of Cincinnati, please, you know, I can get you in touch with those folks. Again, I said we're doing this Precious Planet Award, which is a science fair award. If there are schools that would be interested in participating in that, again, they can reach out to me. And if there are any schools that are thinking, hey, maybe we might be interested in doing composting our food, our lunch waste, our food waste, again, they can always contact me. And I may not be able to do it, but I know a lot of people that might be able to do it.
Jen Morin Williamson is Peace, Justice, and Ecology Coordinator for Sisters of Precious Blood in Dayton. Jen, thanks so much for your time and the information, and we'll certainly encourage our listeners to come visit your website and see how they can help with some of the climate solutions that people are looking for today.
Thank you.
Wetlands play an important role in stormwater management, clean water, and more. A Dayton Regional STEM Schools class worked with Five Rivers Metro Parks recently to propose improvements at Cox Arboretum for this increasingly rare habitat. WISO's Nick Herkman brings us this story as part of our climate solutions coverage.
Over the last several months, the sixth grade class at the Dayton Regional STEM School, Five Rivers Metro Parks, and other partners have been working together to develop ways to strengthen the region's wetlands. Grace Deitch is Director of Conservation for Five Rivers Metro Parks.
Wetlands play an important role in stormwater management, clean water, and it's an increasingly rare habitat. You know, in Ohio alone, and I think it's the same stat for across the country, we've lost over 90% of our wetlands.
Deitch and other Metro Parks employees and partners visited the school on May 6th to see research and presentations from the students. The presentations will inform a restoration project at Cox Arboretum Metro Park. As part of the project, students visited Cox Arboretum to see the wetland environment and learn more about the ecosystem they'd be helping to protect. Doug Tallamy, New York Times bestselling author of Nature's Best Hope, visited the school and spoke to the students. So did Kara Maynard of Deeply Rooted Landscapes, a native plant landscaping company. Sixth grader Janiyah Gaston said she had fun working on the project with her friend Olivia Breen.
My favorite part was when me and Olivia were doing research, we would just start singing random songs and mess around. And
that was the funnest part.
Focusing somehow.
Sarah Paul, a sixth grade social studies teacher at the school, said the project has motivated students to make a difference.
They've been talking a lot about wanting to build their own wetland and build their ecosystem in their own backyard. And so we were able to partner with Five Rivers again, and we got a bunch of native plant seeds, and a lot of kids have been taking them home and planting those. So we're really excited to see them kind of flourish and be excited about making the world a better place.
For WYSO News, I'm Nick Herkman.
Up next on WISO Weekend, the fashion industry creates a lot of pollution, so some Ohio college students are reducing their carbon footprint with clothing swaps. WISO's Adriana Martinez-Smiley brings us this report.
Anywhere from 2,000 to 3,000 tons of trash are brought here to the Montgomery County Waste Transfer Station south of Dayton each day. The county's most recent data from 2014 shows that textiles, like clothing, make up 8% of that waste. Kelly Bohr is the program specialist with Montgomery County Solid Waste District. She says nationally, waste management districts and recycling companies are aware it's an increasing problem.
There's just not the infrastructure yet, especially here in Montgomery County, for that textile recycling that forms it right back into new clothes.
That uptick in textile waste can be attributed to an emerging phenomenon known as fast fashion. Colorado State University Associate Professor Sonali Didi has studied the fashion industry for over 20 years.
Fast fashion is a term used for any pieces of clothing or fashion items, which includes shoes, bags, which are produced at a very low price. The speed to market is the core reason of their existence.
Think those PacSun jeans or that Shein crop top. Didi says clothing like that creates pollution through every part of its life cycle. From the fossil fuels burned to manufacture garments, to the engine exhaust from planes and ships for distribution, to its ultimate fate at a methane-emitting landfill.
The numbers which are out there for our total greenhouse gas emissions are around 1.2 billion tons annually, which is about 10% of our global carbon emission.
While it's a global issue, the Hanley Sustainability Institute at the University of Dayton brings a solution closer to home, or campus. That's through its clothing swaps, which it hosts three times a semester.
Thanks for stopping by.
In the shuffle between classes, a stream of students browse racks and tables teeming with pants, shorts, t-shirts, blouses, and button-ups. Everything here is donated by students and free. UD junior Zayman Tyke is a student leader with the Sustainability Institute, and he founded the initiative a couple years ago.
As a younger person, this like fast fashion industry in general, they produce like trending clothing that are very attractive to us so that people want to buy. And at the same time, the prices are also like very affordable. But the issue with it is that these clothes that we buy are not durable.
Since the program started less than 2 years ago, the team says they've diverted nearly 900 pounds of clothes from landfills, and including almost 500 pounds swapped among students. They donate excess clothing to the social services nonprofit St. Vincent de Paul in Dayton. UD freshman Mary Eli Holden grabbed a pair of black flowy pants from Marshalls with a tag still on them at the March swap.
I'm broke. I'm a college student. So... but I do like affordability. I'm always at the thrift stores, and I also like the sustainable aspect of it. You know, landfills are full, fast fashion is on the rise. So anything we can do to like reduce our carbon footprint and like our effect on the earth, I'm all for.
Other universities have similar initiatives. Although its clothing isn't free, Ohio State University student group Buckeye Clothing Connection hosts thrifting and donation events. And Ohio University campus groups host clothing swaps, too. By younger people showing they care about sustainability, Zayman Tyke says it can challenge bigger corporations to change for the better. For the Ohio Newsroom, I'm Adriana Martinez-Smiley.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. It's all about climate solutions this weekend. Coming up, we've got Today from the Ohio Newsroom, but up next... The average price for a new electric car is just under $60,000, but some people are finding a more affordable way to go electric. About 1.5 million e-bikes were sold in the U.S. in 2025, and that number is forecast to keep growing, according to Global Market Insights. E-bikes make it easier to ride around without as much physical exertion than a conventional bike. WISO's Mike Frazier spoke with Mike Bissig, owner of Mike's Bike Park, to learn more about the trend.
It's still very much a bicycle. You pedal it, you shift gears, you ride it just like a bicycle. It just also has the ability to assist you in that process. So depending on, you know, what bike you get, depending on what class you get, they will have things like pedal assist, which means you're doing the pedaling, but the bike is helping you along. So most of those e-bikes are going to have different levels of assist. So if you just want just a little bit of help, maybe getting up a hill or something like that, it can help you out. If you want a lot of help just because you want to get up that hill even faster, or maybe it's a really steep hill so you want some more help on that, that pedal assist will sort of help you ride the bike. But you're still physically doing that.
So top speed, does that mean that if you reach a certain speed, it'll slow it down by itself?
Nope, it'll just stop helping you.
I see.
So, you know, I like riding a bike, and I've certainly been known to, try to see how fast I can go on my bicycle at times. So I have certainly many times pedaled faster than 28 miles an hour on my road bike. So if you were to do that on an e-bike and you had it set to where, you know, it would help you up to 28, you know, once you hit 28 miles an hour. If you wanted to go 29, you are pedaling it past that. The bike isn't helping you go any faster than that. It's going to sort of, it's like a governor on a car or on a lawnmower or something like that. It's going to cap the top speed of the bike.
And you change those settings using the screen on the bike, or is there like a control on the handlebars or on the hand grips? It's,
everything's controlled with the sort of the control center on the handlebars. So you'll have a little, a set of buttons on the handlebar and the screen. So those set of buttons will, determine how what that level is, how fast the bike's going to go, as well as some other things. So you get to control that the whole time. The bike never does anything that you don't want it to do.
Now, being an e-bike, there's a battery in there, I assume. How long would the battery last?
Most bikes these days will be on the low end, maybe 60 or 65 miles of range per charge, up to even, close to 90 miles of range without sort of any extended battery. And if you find that you are a person that does ride longer than that, or maybe you're going, on a 2 or 3 day long bike ride, they've got some battery extenders. You can get, other batteries. So you can take the battery out and put a new battery in. So there's ways to extend it beyond that.
Now, do those batteries wear out over time? I know like car batteries, that have to be replaced every couple of years. Is it the same with an e-bike battery?
Yeah, just the same as, anything that we have that has a battery, it has a lifespan on it. So most of those batteries, we tell our customers, you can, if you used it heavily all the time, it might get less. But in general, I always say you should expect to get 4 to 5 years out of a battery actually using the bike. If you, never use it, just like everything else, that can and sometimes, make the battery not last as long. If you use it, every single day, it's just as hard as it possibly can, it might not last 5 years. But generally speaking, our customers are seeing 4 to 5 years easy. I've got plenty of customers that, bought an e-bike from us 8 years ago, and they still have not replaced the battery.
And how much do they cost?
Depends on the model. That type of technology is always getting cheaper. So I would say, I would expect right now, today, May of 2026, to be somewhere between $200 and $400 for a replacement battery, depending on what the battery is and what the bike is. So they're always, trying to lower that cost, obviously. But in that $200 to $400 range to replace a battery.
What advice would you give to someone who's always ridden a conventional bike that they may want to consider an e-bike? What would you tell them?
So the electric aspect is, it's great. I mean, it's not just simply I want an electric version of the bike that I'm already riding. In many ways, it is opening up, getting exercise, getting out, getting active to a whole new set of people who have been limited in some way, shape, or form, just, by the physical aspect of riding a bike. Now they have a bike that can help them. Now they're getting out and getting on the trails and stuff. So that's been one of my favorite things about the e-bike, is just that, we've been able to open up a whole world out there to some customers that would have never been able to experience that. And it's a great thing.
Mike Bissig, owner of Mike's Bike Park, speaking with WISO's Mike Frazier. This is WISO Weekend.
Today from the Ohio Newsroom, the magic of biochar.
Support comes from the James at Ohio State. Cancer. For some, it's one of life's fiercest foes. But not at the James, where a team of nearly 300 specialists and over 1,500 researchers are working together to create a cancer-free world.
This week, the Ohio Newsroom is joining NPR to tell local stories about climate solutions as the federal government walks back environmental regulations. I'm Erin Gottsacker. In Cincinnati, local parks have been using an ingredient called biochar to help trees grow. They've been purchasing it from out of state, but soon the city will be making its own. From Ohio Newsroom member station WVXU, and with support from Isabel Nisley, Becca Costello reports.
Make some noise if you love trees.
On Arbor Day in 2025, Cincinnati Mayor Aftab Purval hyped up students at an elementary school.
And here's the most exciting thing, guys. You are part of history. So today, we are using a magical ingredient for the first time in Cincinnati's history. It's called biochar. Yeah.
Biochar is more science than magic, but it's pretty powerful. The charcoal-like material can enrich soil and keep climate-warming carbon out of the atmosphere. Here's how that works. Cincinnati Parks Director Jason Barron says the parks produce a lot of wood waste, like dead trees and trimmed branches.
And that wood waste was just decomposing and releasing that carbon back into the air. And this allows us to take what we already have and turn it into something that's beneficial, not just for us, but for others.
To make biochar, wood is burned at a high temperature with little oxygen, which traps the carbon so it can't get out. When biochar is mixed with compost or manure, it becomes an excellent fertilizer, helping plants grow faster and taking even more carbon out of the atmosphere. Cincinnati is working with a private company, Carbon Harvest, to build a warehouse with a machine that can make biochar on a large scale, at least 300 tons a year. About two-thirds will be sold, making the project financially self-sustaining in the long run. Barron says what's left will be mixed with manure from a farm and equestrian center at a county park, then used to plant trees in Cincinnati.
The goal of the project, of course, is to grow trees faster and therefore increase our urban canopy and increase all of the benefits that has.
Neighborhoods with fewer trees experience more flooding and higher temperatures. And in Cincinnati, lower-income neighborhoods tend to have the fewest trees. Crystal Courtney is trying to change that. She manages urban forestry with Cincinnati Parks and just last month helped plant 27 trees at an elementary school in Over the Rhine.
The biochar and the compost will provide more nutrients than what you see kind of in our very clayey soil here. So we'll hold more nutrients and moisture close to the root system.
Newly planted trees often struggle in urban environments. Research says a biochar and compost mix helps urban trees grow faster and live longer. Its worldwide potential is much broader. Making biochar can also produce a type of renewable energy. And when it comes to resource-intensive agriculture, biochar can increase crop yields while decreasing dependence on climate-polluting fertilizers. So could biochar save the world?
Climate change is such a humongous problem that humanity and planet Earth has never seen before.
That's Ratan Lal, Distinguished University Professor of Soil Science at The Ohio State University. He says we need to stop burning fossil fuels, too.
For this humongous problem, there is no one solution. Everything is on the table.
That includes biochar. And Jason Barron says Cincinnati wants to lead the way. He's hoping other cities follow in their footsteps and start making biochar, too.
They'll see the success we have and other people want to do it. And then ultimately that will lead to not just healthier, faster growing trees in Cincinnati, but faster growing trees throughout the region. And then growing that industry and growing that technology across the country.
For the Ohio Newsroom, I'm Becca Costello reporting with Isabel Nisley.
That's all today from the Ohio Newsroom. We'll talk with you tomorrow.
Up next on WISO Weekend, the Ohio River Basin spans more than 200,000 square miles across 15 states, including Pennsylvania, Kentucky, and of course, Ohio. But unlike other major watersheds, it doesn't have a dedicated EPA office or the funding that comes with it. The Ohio River Basin Alliance, a Cincinnati-based cooperative, has spent the past two decades working to change that. And with two federal bills introduced in the House and Senate, the tide may finally be turning. Zariah Johnson with IdeaStream Public Media spoke to the Ohio Newsroom's Aaron Gottsacker about this effort.
Hi, Zariah.
Hi, Aaron.
So why doesn't the Ohio River Basin currently get a pool of federal funding? And why is this money needed?
Yeah, it's a watershed that was overlooked in the early 2000s and 2010s when other watersheds were getting just that, federal funding and the regional EPA representation that comes with it. And this is what the Ohio River Basin Alliance and other advocates are looking for today. They realized early on that there's an awareness issue that comes with the basin that other watersheds like the Great Lakes or the Chesapeake Bay aren't dealing with. Alliance Chair Chris Lorenz told me that people know the location of the Ohio River and where they live in relation to that, but when it comes to knowing whether or not they live somewhere in the basin within those 15 states, there's less awareness there. So at this point, the Alliance is asking for a federal investment of $350 million annually for the Ohio River Basin. And it sounds like a large investment, but Lorenz says it's less costly than taking on remediation work later on.
Okay, got it. Well, up until this point, cities and states and nonprofits along the river have taken their own steps to preserve the basin. Can you give us an example of some of those piecemeal efforts? Have they seen much success?
Yeah, we've seen a fair amount of success stories here in Ohio. We've got the H2 Ohio program started by Governor Mike DeWine in 2019, which funds the preservation of Lake Erie, its watershed, and large rivers in the state, including the Ohio River and portions of its watershed. But this effort only extends as far as the state's boundary line, and the same can be said for local organizations here in Ohio. They're doing good work when it comes to conservation efforts, like river cleanups or even research efforts, but they can only go so far.
Okay, so how would the proposed federal legislation change the way the Ohio River Basin is protected?
The $350 million annual federal investment outlined in the legislation would support basin-wide conservation efforts to protect it from longstanding threats like stormwater or agricultural runoff, but also from emerging threats including invasive species, forever chemicals called PFAS, and microplastics. It would also establish the Ohio River National Program Office, so that would be the dedicated office that would operate out of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to provide a basin-wide approach to handling the funding, research, conservation work, and preservation work at the federal level.
Well, this legislation is being considered at a time when federal support for a lot of other climate and sustainability projects has been walked back. Does this have much of a chance of passing?
The alliance is hopeful that it will pass, especially considering the two bills introduced in the House and Senate at this point have already received some bipartisan support. The alliance has worked to get the attention of elected officials within the basin since its founding in 2009, and they're working on establishing a caucus with those representatives, and they're about halfway there so far. Chris Lorenz with the Ohio River Basin Alliance told me that to do that, they almost had to take the climate piece out of the conversation and focus instead on the lived experiences felt throughout the basin, including things like flooding, drought, and habitat loss.
Soraya Johnson with IdeaStream Public Media speaking with the Ohio Newsroom's Aaron Gottsacker. I'm Jerry Kenny. This is WISO Weekend.
This is Bird Note. I'm Deja Perkins, an urban ecologist, and I'd like to give you a crash course on urban birding. There's nothing like the sound of the eastern towhee reminding you to drink your tea first thing in the morning. In the eastern U.S., these are not birds you have to travel far to see. In fact, you can see the eastern towhee and many other birds just by taking a walk around your neighborhood. One of the reasons I love birds is that you don't have to go far to find them. You can sit on your porch, at your local park, or even in the parking lot of your favorite store, and you will find birds. All it takes is at least 5 minutes of mindfulness. If you don't see anything right away, don't be discouraged. Remember to look up. Maybe you will catch a vulture soaring overhead on a warm, breezy day, or the flash of red on a red-tailed hawk as it soars by. Check the power lines, light poles, and tops of buildings for the electric blue flash of the eastern bluebird. Close your eyes. Listen. Past the sounds of the cars and the traffic, past the sounds of people chatting nearby. Do you hear it? Drink your tea. This week is Blackbirders Week. To learn how to participate, follow the hashtag Blackbirders Week on social media and visit birdnote.org. I'm Deja Perkins.
Bird Note putting a wrap on this week's edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks so much for spending your weekends with WISO. This program is available as a podcast wherever you download and subscribe to your podcasts. And please share us on social media. Our theme music is Another Beautiful Day in Paradise by Magnolia Bolthead. We've got more stories, highlights, and conversations for you coming up next weekend. Please join us then.